Chapter 70. Seeley, Clover Bar, London, February 1918. Clover Bar, Ither Green, London, February 6th, 1918. Dearest, darling Max, it has happened. Parliament has passed the Representation of the People Act. Women have been given the vote. Not all women, not yet. Only women over 30 who live in a house. But it's a start. They have given the vote to all men over the age of 21 as well, no matter whether they own a property or not. The government simply couldn't justify denying us all the vote after our contributions in this war. There is still much to be done, Max, to push for universal suffrage for all adult women. So many young women have given so much of themselves, nursing, working in the munitions factories, farming, and keeping the country running all these years. I shall be meeting with Mrs. Fawcett next week about our next steps, but I had to share this with you as soon as I heard it. You are in my thoughts day and night, Max. Come back to me as soon as you can. Your Shatzi. Seeley blots the letter on her desk blotter and folds it carefully. She opens her desk drawer and adds it to the other letters. She shuts the drawer and picks up Max's brass button from a glass dish on her desk. God mit uns. God is with us. I hope so, Max. I hope so. Chapter 71. Max. Northern Russia, March 1918. Max falls into a snowbank and throws his arm over his eyes against the glare of the midday sun. His body sinks into the melting snow, and for a moment he imagines himself back in his boyhood bed, safe from the horrors that even he, with a boy's vivid imagination, could not have conjured up, but which he now, after the long years of the war, has come to accept with exhausted resignation. The life he had once known as a student in Heidelberg and teaching in London seems like a long-lost dream. The only thing that keeps him alive is Seeley. When he thinks of her now, she is a flash of auburn hair, a quick smile, and eyes the colour of the Russian winter sky. And the scent of lilacs, always the scent of lilacs. She comes to him in his dreams, but slides away before he can touch her. Were you a dream too, Seeley? Someone flops into the snow beside him and pokes him in his shoulder. Max turns his head toward the broad, flat-cheeked face of the German soldier. What, Lucas? The break is over already? The soldier holds out a burning, rolled-up cigarette. I got it from the guard. Max sits up and takes the cigarette. Sasha? Yeah, I had to trade my wedding ring for it. Burns like shit, but beggars can't be choosers, right? Max takes a long draught of the cigarette and exhales a stream of blue smoke. He hands the cigarette back and looks over at the other POWs, hammering in the new railway line. Rumour has it, the Bolsheviks want out of the war. Lucas sucks at the cigarette and blows out a smoke ring. They got the Tsar and his family under house arrest. Did you hear that? Yeah, not good. Max stretches his arms and pats the snow off the sleeves of his army coat. Snow's melting. Spring is coming. Like it makes a difference to us. Max looks across the snowy landscape. It's only 200 kilometres to the Finnish border. The worst of the winter is over. All we need is a chance, Lucas. Lucas sinks the cigarette stub into the snow. Like that will ever happen. A roar erupts further down the rail line, which ripples through the Russian guards like a surging wave. Max and Lucas rise from the snowbank and watch as the guards run at each other, shouting and embracing. You're good at languages, Max. What are they shouting? Peace. Land. Bread. Peace, land, bread. That's it. No, there's something else. He looks at the German. Russia has left the war. We're free, Lucas. Lucas whoops and throws his arms around Max. We are free, Max. We are free. Finally, this shitty war is finished. It's only finished in Russia. We'll be shipped back to France to fight the Americans. Lucas spits into the snow. Shit. Max turns to the soldier and slaps him on his back. He slaps the German on his arm. Good luck, Lucas. It's been good to know you. He turns and heads through the snow toward the western horizon. Max, where are you going? Home. I'm going home. Chapter 72. Seeley. Clover Bar, London, March 1918. Christina sifts through the post as she enters the dining room. She pulls out a letter, dirty and torn around the edges, its black ink smudged. Another letter from Frank Jeffries, Cecilia. It appears you have an admirer. Seeley scrapes a thin layer of butter onto a slice of the dense brown war loaf with studied disinterest. She gouges out a sliver of potato skin from the cold toast with a knife. I have a fiancé, Mama. I'm simply corresponding to keep Frank's spirits up. You won't mind, then, if I open it and read it out? Seeley reaches across the table and plucks the letter from her mother's hand. I would rather you didn't, if you don't mind. If you excuse me, I have an article to write. 56th, London Infantry Division, near Arras, France. March 19th, 1918. Dear Seeley, thank you for your recent letter and all your news from London. You must be over the moon about women over 30 obtaining the vote after all your hard work. I am so pleased about that. And thank you for the socks. My feet, thank you enormously. We, soldiers, not feet, have been stuck in these trenches for the past 6 weeks now, wedged together like sardines. There's nothing but a string of barbed wire between us and the Germans, but at least we know those fellows are as tired as we are, though they're being joined by reinforcements from the Eastern Front, now that Russia is out of the war. It's all mud and cold and fog, and everything is dull grey and brown, as if the war had leached all the colour out of the world. The battlefields of the Somme are nearby, and we can't help but feel dread weighing down on us. But now I'm the proud wearer of green socks, and I am the envy of the fellows here. You have no idea how a small thing like that makes such a great difference. The Germans are up to something. We can all feel it. They're sure to be nervous about the Americans joining up with us. I've met a few of these so-called doughboys already. Big fellows, all brash and full of bravado with names like Karpenko and O'Gallagher. Hopeless at cards, except for poker, which they're all mad for. I've heard a black unit from Harlem in New York has just arrived down the line and is being trained by the French army, though I haven't seen any of them yet. Over 300,000 more doughboys are coming over next month. Not a moment too soon, if you ask me. Seeley, I've had some bad news. My brother John has died from the wounds he suffered in Italy in the autumn. He was in a hospital in Vicenza. I received a letter from my father yesterday. John was only 21. I remember climbing the neighbour's apple tree with John when we were boys, egging each other on to see who could find the fattest, juiciest apple without being seen by old Mr. Frampton. Somehow, John always managed it. He was like a squirrel. Your poor father, and now my brother. When will this all stop? This war is an abomination. I'm so sorry. I'm cold, and everything is damp, and I can't even imagine what it feels like to be warm and dry anymore. We're all tired and fed up. We know there is fighting ahead, and it's nothing but luck which will see who makes it to the end. I don't know what my destiny is. Whatever happens, I want you to know that your letters have sustained me through this last long year. I shall do everything I can to be one of the fellows who makes it out of here, so that I can see you again in London, and thank you with all my heart. Yours affectionately, Frank. Celie blinks at the last sentence. What does he mean by thank you with all my heart? He knows she has a fiancé. She mustn't read too much into it. He's simply grateful, as any poor soldier at the front would be, for some kind letters and warm socks. She picks up the framed photograph of Max that she'd taken of him at her birthday party. Sadness and yearning rise inside her, and she blinks away the tears that spring into her eyes. You'd understand me writing to Frank, wouldn't you, Max? When I write him, it's like I'm writing to you. Both of you, out there, fighting this awful, endless war. Come back to me, Max. Please. Just come back to me.
Chapter 73. Jessie. Cairo, Egypt. April 1918. Jessie! What are you doing here? Ivy Roach nods at the covered bedpan she is carrying. You can't be missing this, even if the hospital is in a palace.
Jessie hovers in the doorway of the former palace's ballroom on Citadel Hill. Now, despite its soaring ceiling and painted rococo panels and pilasters, a vast ward in Cairo's Citadel Hospital. She looks past Ivy at the beds of soldiers and the bustling orderlies and nurses. I actually do miss all of this, Ivy. Can you spare a few minutes?
Sure. It's time for my break anyway. Let me get rid of this. I'll meet you outside by the fountain. It's my favourite place. An oasis of calm.
She chuckles.
That's clever, isn't it? An oasis in Egypt. I've got to remember that one.
Jessie sits on the fountain's wide marble base and smiles at Ivy as she pats the head of one of the four diminutive stone lions that spout water into the pool.
I can see why you like it here. You think more people would come out here. Usually, it's just me and the boys.
She nods at the lions.
Fred, Stanley, Howard, and Walter. They're not very fierce names. They're not very fierce lions.
Jessie laughs.
You're right about that.
Ivy takes a pear out of her pocket.
You don't mind if I eat this, do you? I'm famished. Didn't have time for lunch.
Go ahead. You should peel it first.
I like to live dangerously.
Ivy takes a bite of the juicy pear.
So, what brings you to my neck of the woods?
She scrutinizes the palace's colonnade with its graceful Romanesque arches.
Gotta say, it's a sight better than the hospital in Alexandria.
Jessie trails her hand in the cool water. I'm at a loose end, Ivy. There's only so much gardening and cooking lessons and bandage rolling I can take. Don't get me started on the British black satin and pearl set at the Jazeera Sporting Club.
So, you're slumming it here with me because you've had enough of those spoiled bitches. Ivy!
Ivy shrugs.
It's true, isn't it?
You have a crystal chandelier the size of a Christmas tree in your ward. I wouldn't call this slumming it.
Suppose not.
Ivy licks the sticky pear juice off her thumb.
So? What's up?
Oh, Ivy, Aziz is so busy with his new position at the Anglo-American Hospital,
I'm lucky if I'm still awake when he gets home at night.
Sounds like the perfect marriage to me.
Ivy, I'm bored.
What are you going to do about it?
I want to feel useful. It's one of the reasons I liked nursing. I hated having to give it up when I married. Living in Cairo isn't what I imagined.
Ivy tosses the percor into a clump of blue plumbago.
So, you want to feel useful?
Yes, I do.
Jessie wipes at the film of sweat collecting on her forehead under the brim of her straw hat.
Spit it out, Jessie. I can see something percolating in that head of yours.
The house is so big. We have 4 reception rooms, Ivy. Who needs 4 reception rooms? So I've been thinking, what if I were to open a health clinic in one of the reception rooms?
Don't all those posh expats go to the Anglo-American hospital?
Not for the expats, Ivy. For Egyptians. The hospitals are bursting with soldiers. I have no idea where the locals go when they're sick. I don't mean the rich, of course. They can pay for whatever they need. I mean everyone else.
Sounds like a good idea to me. You can patch people up pretty well. And you worked in obstetrics and paediatrics in London, didn't you? That'll come in handy.
The thing is, I'm British and I don't speak Arabic. Do you suppose anyone would come?
Maybe get your sister-in-law to be your translator and help spread the word. I'm happy to do whatever I can on my days off.
I've sworn off blokes for the time being.
You want to know something I've discovered?
What's that?
They're all just after one thing, and it's not a wedding ring.
Don't tell me. Aren't you into?
Too right.
Jessie looks at the 4 stone lions, at their gaping mouths spewing water.
The clinic's a mad idea, of course. She'll need Aziz's help, but he's sure to support her if he thinks it will make her happy.
And Zara. Yes, that's a good idea. Zara would be a perfect administrator.
What Leila Khalid will think of her British daughter-in-law turning one of the villa's grand reception rooms into a walk-in clinic for Cairo's underclass is another matter entirely.
Chapter 74. Jessie, Alta Menina, Cairo, Egypt, April 1918.
Aziz, a word, please.
Yes, Mama.
What is it?
She nods towards the library.
In here.
Aziz follows her through the double doors. His mother stands in front of the bow window in her black silk clothing, as elegant as a black swan.
Yes. What is it, Mama? I am late. I am sure Jessica is wondering where I am.
I wouldn't worry about her. She has been out at the sporting club all day with her kind. Why you saw fit to marry an Englishwoman?
She spits out the word like a sour pill.
Your poor father would spin in his grave.
Aziz's jaw clenches. You are speaking about my wife. Do not disrespect her. If you are unhappy about this living arrangement, I have no doubt one of your Turkish or Albanian relatives will be happy to have you. Don't pretend you love Egyptians. You have not one drop of Egyptian blood in your body. You were only too happy to make that point with my Egyptian father. He was only with the Khedive in Constantinople on that fool's errand to curry favour with the Turks to please you. If it hadn't been for your greed...
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I am not a fool, Mama. I saw how you harried my father until he gave in to your greed for status and wealth.
Aziz sweeps his hand around the room with its gleaming mahogany bookcases and leather-topped reading table.
He gave you everything you ever wanted.
Don't be a hypocrite, Aziz. I don't see you living in a shack in the Mokattam Hills, ministering to the poor.
I am quite busy enough ministering to the war-wounded currently, if you haven't noticed. For the British.
Layla spits out the words like poison darts. I shall never forgive them for deposing my uncle Abbas after your father's death. I have had to work very hard to regain everything my family lost after that. I shall not have that Englishwoman undo all my work. Jessica has no interest in your intrigues. It is one of the many reasons I love her. She is an honest woman. It is no surprise to me that you dislike her. She is nothing like you. Layla Khalid waves her jeweled hand dismissively in the air. I don't wish to speak about this. There's something more pressing I wish to discuss. It has to do with your wife. What are you talking about? I overheard her speaking to Zara this afternoon about a project she wishes to undertake here at Alta Menina. What is wrong with that? It's her home. She is proposing a health clinic for Cairo's poor and unwashed, here, in one of our reception rooms. I'm sure you misunderstood. I did not misunderstand anything. She said it was a shame that so much of the house sits empty, when there are people raising families in nothing more than shacks in the city. Wherever has she been, Aziz? You should keep a closer eye on her. Aziz expels an exhausted breath. I'll speak to her. I should hope so. The executive council of the Anglo-American Hospital would not look kindly on such a venture on their doorstep. I have no doubt they would be pleased to find an excuse to retire the one Egyptian who has slipped onto their staff. A nerve in Aziz's face twitches. I said, I shall speak to her. Jesse hears the tread of footsteps in the hallway outside the old nursery, now transformed into her study, which is tucked under the eaves of the second floor of the mansion. She turns in her desk chair, just as the door bursts open. Jessica, there you are. I have been looking all over for you. She shuts her notebook. Aziz, what is it? Aziz sits in the leather armchair beside the desk. I have just been speaking to my mother. What is this I hear about you opening a health clinic in the house? How did she know about that? She overheard you speaking to Zara. Were you going to tell me about this grand plan? Of course I was, Aziz. It's just a thought at the moment. The truth is, I'm bored witless. I'm used to being so busy. I've never been one for tea parties and gossip with the expat crowd. I understand, but Jessica, a health clinic in Alta Menina. I had a horrid time with the women at the sporting club today, so I went to see Ivy at the Citadel. She thought it was a great idea. She suggested I get Zara involved to help with translation and administration. Ivy said she'd help too, when she could. I thought we could encourage the local population to come. I'd be useful again. I need to be useful, Aziz. Aziz rises from the chair and walks over to a dormer window. He stares out the window for a long moment. Aziz? I am sorry, Jessica. I have left you on your own too much. I can see that. He smiles at her ruefully. I have not been a very attentive husband, but it has been so busy at the hospital. There is no end to the wounded coming in. I know. I remember what it's like. He sits in the chair and takes hold of her hands. I promise to make it up to you, Habibti. Why don't we arrange a trip down to Luxor? We can visit the Temple of Karnak and the Valley of the Kings. You can bring your camera and take photographs to send to your family and tell them all about your Egyptian adventures. What about your work? I have leave accumulated. It can be our proper honeymoon. Jessie throws her arms around Aziz's neck and kisses him. That would be wonderful, Aziz. He looks around the modest room. I remember growing up here with Zara when we were small children.
He rubs his cheek against hers.
Maybe it won't be too long before it will be a nursery again.
What about the health clinic, Aziz? Why don't you set that idea aside until after our honeymoon, Habibti? I shall buy you Baedeker's Guide to Egypt, and you can plan our grand tour. I'll hire a felucca, and we shall sail down the Nile like Cleopatra and Antony.
He glances at his watch. I must go. I have a meeting at the hospital.
He gives her a quick kiss.
Don't hold dinner for me. I shall find something in the kitchen when I am back.
Jessie listens until Aziz's footsteps fade into Alta Menina's early evening silence. She sits down and flips open the notebook. She picks up her pen and adds to her to-do list. Find room in the city for clinic. ASAP. Chapter 75. Seeley, Clover Bar, London, May 1918. Seeley leans back on her heels and brushes a strand of hair out of her eyes. She sets down the garden trowel and raises her face to the warm spring sun. Closing her eyes, she listens to the birds twittering amongst the fading white flowers of the rowan tree. Behind her, the kitchen door slams, and she hears steps on the gravel path. It's a lovely day, isn't it, Seeley Fry?
Frank!
She springs to her feet and slaps at the dirt on her blue skirt.
How lovely to see you! What are you doing here?
I have a few days' leave. I'm going up to Nuneaton on the train later to see my parents, but I wanted to stop by here first.
I'm delighted, but look at the state of me.
You're a sight for sore eyes, Seeley.
Thank you, Frank.
Her heart thumps in her chest, and every intelligent thought flies out of her mind.
I've been sowing seeds in our vegetable patch. Cabbage, cauliflower, runner beans and sprouts. It's the only way to guarantee having them, what with the rationing and shortages. I've had to dig up the hydrangeas to make more room, but needs must. I'm thinking of writing an article about it for the Mirror. I'm trying to convince Mama of having chickens, but, well, you can imagine. She says we're not a farm and that I'd want goats next.
She glances towards the kitchen, conscious she is rambling.
Would you like some tea? I'll ask Hetty to put some on, shall I?
She's ahead of you. She said there was some trench cake in the pantry, too. She and Mama made several cakes to send to the boys at the front. She must have kept one back for us.
Seeley gestures to the garden bench under the cherry tree. Shall we have a seat? It's too nice to go inside today.
Yes, that sounds good.
She perches on the bench and tucks her skirt under her knees. Frank sits beside her and sets his army cap on his knees.
I was so sorry to hear about your father, Seeley. It seems none of us is safe in this war.
Thank you, Frank. It was awful. Poor Mama. She was in pieces after the funeral. I've never seen her like that before. She's always been so stoic.
There were times growing up when I wondered if she had any feelings at all, especially for me.
I'm sure that's not true.
Well, perhaps not.
Forgive me for asking, Seeley, but are you managing all right? Your father provided for you. Because if he hasn't...
Oh, Frank. No, we're fine, really.
Mama had her inheritance from Grandpapa, which Papa had invested wisely, it seems, along with some savings.
She wipes at the dirt, drying in splotches on her hands.
Frank, I'm sorry about your brother. So many young men. Will there ever be an end to it?
Frank runs his fingers along the peak of his army cap.
It was a terrible shock for all of us. John was a wonderful fellow. We were meant to run the business together once the war was over. He was engaged to be married. A lovely girl he'd met at school. Olive Henderson. They were childhood sweethearts. I'm sorry, Frank. Frank nods. Celie, I've often thought about your fiancé, Max Fisher. You have? It was the first battle I was involved in at Gallipoli. I'll never forget that day. It was steaming hot. The whole bay under the Sari Bear Ridge was covered in a fog of smoke from grass fires and the steam from the salt lake. You could barely make out the fellow next to you as you ran up the ridge.
You don't have to tell me this, Frank.
No, I need to, Celie. Frank shifts on the bench. If there is a hell, it can't be worse than Suvla Beach that day. If they'd had machine guns, we would have been goners.
It's like you become a machine, Celie.
One step, and then another step, and another. A figure comes at you through the fog, and you shoot, hoping it's not one of your own. Then you step forward again until the next figure comes at you. He looks at Celie, his brown eyes glistening. What if Max was one of those figures, Celie? What if I...
Stop, Frank. You can't think that. But no, Frank. Please.
Celie glances towards the kitchen.
Wherever is Hetty with our tea? I'll go and see where she is.
Frank grabs her hand. There's something else I came here for.
Yes?
Celie, the past few years in France and Gallipoli, the only thing that's kept me going is the memory of your face and your letters. You're always there, with me, in my mind, when I wake up and when I sleep.
Frank,
I don't know what I can offer you. I only know that I intend to leave Britain behind and make a new life somewhere else after the war. He fumbles in his uniform pocket and takes out a gold ring set with a sparkling square-cut diamond. He slides down to his knee. Celie's heart jumps.
Oh, Frank!
I admire you, Celie. I admire you so very deeply.
It's been 4 years since you've heard from Max. You can't wait for him forever.
I know you don't love me. I understand that. But I hope with all my heart that you will marry me and we could fall in love. I know I can love you, Celie. I would be honoured if you would choose to share your life with me. Cecilia Fry, will you marry me? Celie stares down at Frank, at his lean, handsome face that now holds the shadow of sadness. He is a good man. She knows that with every molecule of her being. But deep inside her, Max still fills the space reserved for love.
I'm sorry, Frank. I already have a fiancé, and that's Max Fisher.
Chapter 76. Etta. Italy, June, July, 1918.
Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, May 24th, 1918. My dearest Carlo, please come as soon as you are able, even if it is for a short visit. Our darling angel Adriana has been taken ill with a flu such as I've never seen, not even when poor Papa was so sick, that winter 5 years ago. Liliana has been with her night and day, but has had to leave today with Mario, as his mother and two sisters and Anna Capri have been taken ill as well. Cousin Stefania and I are doing everything we can, but I am in despair. The doctor is too busy to come. People are falling ill everywhere. He has told me simply to do my best. I'm afraid, Carlo. My darling, why are you not writing to me? I wait every day for your letters, but they never come. Please, God, let you be alive. If I were to lose you both, Etta.
The nurse sets the envelope, tattered and dirty from its circuitous journey to the hospital, on the table beside the soldier's bed, on top of the stack of unopened letters forwarded to the hospital from the Italian front over the long months of the soldier's hospitalization, all in the same blue ink, postmarked Capri, in the delicate, looping handwriting of a woman. She glances at the patient, his handsome face gaunt from the months of his escape into the realm of unconsciousness. But for his injured right hand, which will never hold a pen again, owing to the severed tendons, his body is recovered, but his mind has resisted every attempt at reawakening. She looks at the letters, and her heart goes out to the unknown woman who persists in writing, despite the answering silence. She hesitates for a moment, then she picks up the letter and slips it into her pinafore pocket, knowing that what she is about to do is quite wrong, but certain that God will forgive her. Loyola Unit, Base Hospital, 102, Vicenza, Italy, June 21st, 1918. Dear Mrs. Marinetti, please forgive me for opening your letter to Captain Marinetti, but I felt compelled to contact you. I'm Lieutenant Judy Reynolds, an American nurse at a base hospital near the Italian front. Captain Marinetti was brought into the hospital at the end of October, a casualty of the Battle of Caporetto. He'd sustained several injuries and was progressing well until he fell ill with pneumonia. In his weakened state, the illness took hold, and unfortunately he fell into a coma. While his injuries have now healed, he hasn't emerged from the coma yet. Someone at the front has been forwarding your letters to the hospital here, and I've kept them all for him to read when he wakes up. I'm very sorry to hear that your daughter is sick with the flu. Please don't worry. The flu happens every year, though normally in the winter rather than the spring. Keep her in bed. Give her plenty of fluids, and wash your hands regularly with soap and water. Your most recent letter is dated over a month ago, so hopefully she has recovered by now. If you'd like to write to Captain Marinetti here at the hospital, I'd be happy to give the letters to him as soon as he's better. Send them care of me, at the hospital address on this letter. Yours faithfully, Lieutenant Judith A. Reynolds. Etta hears the iron gate creak and looks up from the pots of pelargonium she is deadheading.
Oh, hello, Bernardo, she says to the postman in Italian. You can give the post to me. I'll bring it inside.
The postman tips his hat and hands Etta a stack of letters.
Bene, bene, signora.
Etta sifts through the envelopes as she enters the villa. One is addressed to her, postmarked Vicenza. She drops the rest of the post onto the hallway table and settles into a sitting-room armchair. She tears open the envelope and reads. She scans the letter a second time, then a third, as her hand begins to shake.
Carlo's in a coma. What if he...
No. She can't think that way. He will be fine. He is alive, and he is out of this war. He is safe now. Soon he will walk through the door of Villa Serenissima, and they will be a family again. She folds the letter and slips it into her pocket. She looks out the window at the sky as blue as cornflowers. She will go to Santo Stefano this afternoon and light a candle for Carlo's swift recovery, just as she'd done every day during Adriana's illness. Then she will work in the vegetable garden and help Liliana make supper, and finally finish one of her paintings. When Carlo returns, He will see how strong she has become, how capable. She sees now that she has been a child all of her life, wheedling and charming her way out of responsibility, looking for other people to smooth her path in the world, to solve her problems. She will do everything she can to hold her family together. It is time for her to become a woman.
There you are, Cara, Stefania says, as she enters the sitting room with a stack of letters. You brought in the post, I see. Any word from your soldier?
Etta glances at Stefania. You mean my husband?
Tina, he has a wife. You know it is impossible.
I am his real wife, cousin Stefania. But no, nothing from him.
No doubt you will hear from him soon. Are you ready to go to the market? Liliana is looking for calamari for supper, and you know she is not to be disappointed.
Chapter 77. Jessie. Cairo, Egypt, June 1918. The landlord flips through the iron keys on his large keyring, muttering to himself as he rejects one after another. Zara Khalid huffs under her face veil and scolds him in agitated Arabic. He waves his gnarled hand and mumbles irritably as he slots a key into the keyhole. The key turns and a bolt drops. The old door creaks as he pushes it open. Zara darts her cold amber eyes along the narrow, dusty street, heaving with donkey carts and food sellers, shooing away cats and shouting out enticements to the shuffling crowds. Go in quickly, Jessica. This is not a good area. There are many thieves around here. Ivy pokes Jessie's back.
Go on. I don't fancy the way that fish seller is looking at me.
The landlord, who, with his stooped shoulders and face as lined as old leather, looks 80, but could be 30 years younger, shuffles around the room, throwing open the shutters. Shards of sunlight slice into the darkness through the small, filthy windows, though Jessie can't help but think that the illumination does the room no favours. Ivy coughs and flaps at the dust hanging in the stale air.
What a tip! It's the worst one yet.
Zara nods. Yes, I am sorry to waste your time. I shall tell him it is not acceptable.
Jessie scans the large room.
No, wait. It's really not all that bad.
Not all that bad?
Ivy kicks at a broken pot on the dirty tiled floor.
Are we in the same room?
No, really, Ivy. It's much larger than the other places we've seen. There's even a tap in the wall over there, so we can have water.
Jessie points to two light bulbs dangling from wires in the ceiling. There's electricity, and it's in the type of neighbourhood that can benefit from a clinic.
It just needs some titivating. Use your imagination.
My imagination isn't that good.
Jessie looks at Zara, who is peeking under a tattered sheet tossed over a piece of furniture.
What do you think, Zara? Do you think we can make this into a clinic?
It would give me great pleasure to make this into your clinic. I have imagination.
Jessie runs her finger along an empty shelf and wrinkles her nose at her grimy fingertip.
Has Aziz asked you anything about the clinic, Zara?
He did. But I told him to mind his own business.
Ivy laughs. Bet he took that, Will.
My brother knows better than to argue with me, Ivy. This is a skill I share with my mother. That and obstinacy.
Jessie rubs her hands together.
It's settled, then. We'll take it.
Ivy holds up a finger.
Hold on just one minute, Jessie. I want to make 100% sure you know what you're doing.
Ivy, we've already talked about this. I want to open the clinic more than anything. I can finally be useful again.
You'll never be able to show your face at the Jazeera Sporting Club again. All those officers' wives are going to have a field day gossiping about us.
I don't give a fig about them. What about Aziz? Aren't you supposed to be planning your honeymoon? You'll come around to the idea.
I'll make sure of that. Zara laughs under her veil. You are becoming a Khalid, Jessica.
Can you see if you can negotiate a good rental price with the landlord, Zara?
Of course.
I shall tell him it is entirely unacceptable and work up to a reluctant agreement.
A shape moves in the chair by the bedroom window.
Aziz, Jessie says, as she sets her hat on the dressing table. I didn't see you. You gave me a fright.
I am sorry, Jessica. I didn't mean to.
I wasn't expecting you until this evening.
It was such a lovely day, and it wasn't busy at the hospital, so I thought I would come and spend it with my wife. But alas, she wasn't to be found, and neither was Zara.
Jessie sits on the vanity stool. I'm sorry, Aziz. I wish I'd known. Zara wanted to show me some of her favourite shops in the souk.
Why then did Marta pack you a lunch? You could easily have bought food in the souk.
Jessie pats her belly. My tummy's a bit delicate. I didn't want to risk it.
You're not?
No, nothing like that.
He smiles. All the more reason for us to take our honeymoon. How are the arrangements coming along? It will have to be in the autumn. It is Ramadan shortly, and then it will be too hot the rest of the summer.
Jessie runs her brush through her hair. It's all fine.
Jessica.
What?
I know where you have been. Marta told me.
Jessie sits down the brush and turns to face her husband. I'm sorry, Aziz. I should have told you myself, but you didn't seem too keen on the idea of the health clinic.
What made you think that?
Well, when I told you about it, you changed the subject to the honeymoon and didn't seem to want to talk about it.
Jessica, I don't think the health clinic is a bad idea at all. Just not in Alta Manina.
Oh, I see.
Marta said you have been looking for a place in the city for the clinic. I wish you had told me. There are many areas that are not safe. I would have sent Mustafa with you. Zara should have known better.
Don't blame Zara, Aziz. It's my fault.
My mother always said I'm too bloody stubborn for my own good.
Your mother is right, Habibti.
Aziz rises and walks over to the vanity table. He rests his hands on Jessie's shoulders and looks at their reflection in the mirror.
I am happy that you have found something that excites you, Jessica. I shall help you, however I can.
Even if it means postponing our honeymoon.
Luxor is not going anywhere, and neither am I.
Chapter 78. Seeley. London, November 1918. Seeley steps down from the omnibus and stands on the pavement in front of the school. In the paved yard outside, children run around, screeching and laughing. A group of boys shouts as they swing stringed conkers at each other, and girls skip and play hopscotch. New yellow brick patches the walls where the bomb blast had torn away parts of the building, and the new windows gleam in the midday light. Like it had always been this way. Like nothing had ever happened. She heads around the corner and walks past the shop with its Woodbine cigarette sign. She stops at the Smith's dark blue door and knocks. The door swings open. Mrs. Smith stands there in a floral dress and carpet slippers, her hair greyer than Seeley remembers.
Miss Fry, this is a surprise.
Hello, Mrs. Smith.
Celie holds out a paper bag. I brought some pastries from Taroni's for you and Millie. I thought you might like them for your victory tea. I'm sorry I haven't been in touch. Things have been so busy at the newspaper, and I've been meeting with Mrs. Fawcett about pursuing the vote for all women. You haven't heard? Heard? Heard what? Mrs. Smith takes hold of Celie's arm and ushers her into the narrow hallway. It's my Millie, Miss Fry. How is she, Mrs. Smith? I can't believe it's been... My goodness, was it Christmas when I was last here? Where is she? I haven't missed her, have I? Miss Fry, our Millie's passed. Toxic jaundice, they called it.
They won't say it, but it's the TNT what did it. Destroyed her liver.
Celie sucks in a breath. Millie's died. When? June. Just like little Alice and Joey. June's a cruel month. Their pa's gone too. Somewhere in France. It's just me now. Doesn't seem right, does it? Where is she?
In the East End Cemetery, with her brothers and sisters. At least they've got each other.
Celie kneels down in the damp grass beside the headstone. Smith. John George. August 14th, 1896 to June 16th, 1899. Nancy Ann. July 7th, 1898 to June 18th, 1899. Alice Mary, March 11th, 1908 to June 13th, 1916. Joseph Peter, February 17th, 1910 to June 13th, 1916. Millicent Jane, September 8th, 1894 to June 20th, 1918. She runs her fingers over Millie's name. She takes the reflex camera out of her handbag and, focusing on the headstone, presses the shutter. No, Mrs. Smith, it's not right at all. Chapter 79. Etta. Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, November 1918.
Cousin Stefania! Carlo's coming home!
Stefania sets down the novel she is reading. Carlo's written? Etta runs into the sitting room, flapping a letter.
He's in a hospital in Vicenza. A nurse there has been writing to me since June. He'd been terribly ill in a coma, but he's woken up. She sent me this letter that he's dictated to her. He says that someone forwarded all my letters to him from the Italian front, and he's been reading them over and over. Isn't it wonderful?
Stefania removes her spectacles and sets them on top of her novel. She hadn't recognised the nurse's handwriting. That's how the letters had slipped through.
I'm so pleased for you, Cara. But why didn't you tell me about this before? I suppose I didn't want to say anything in case... In case... Well, he's awake now. He says he loves me and Adriana and will come back as soon as he's fit to travel. My darling Carlo is coming home.
Stefania coughs and dabs at her forehead with a handkerchief.
Is it hot in here? Has Mario laid a fire? Hot? It's blowing a gale outside. In fact, I should ask Mario to lay the fire when he gets back from Anna Capri, now that you mention it.
Stefania fans her face with a handkerchief and shivers.
I think I shall go and have a rest, Tina. I must have caught a chill.
She rises and sways unsteadily before she sinks to the ground.
Cousin Stefania!
Signora,
What has happened? Mario drops the basket of fresh bread he is carrying and rushes over. Etta falls to her knees and cradles her cousin's head in her arms.
Mario, thank God! Where's Adriana?
She wanted to stay with my grandmother. Nonna will bring her back on Wednesday. She wipes her cousin's feverish face with a sodden handkerchief.
It's best she stay there for now. Help me get Cousin Stefania to her room. This came on so suddenly. She was fine at breakfast this morning.
Mario's face blanches.
The Spanish lady?
Etta nods.
I think so.
Etta leans over Stefania and wipes at the old woman's brow with a cold cloth. Each breath her cousin takes rasps like a rusty hinge. Etta dips the cloth into a bowl of cold water and, folding it in half, lays it across Stefania's burning forehead. Stefania opens her eyes, blinking as she focuses on Etta's face. She sucks in a laboured breath and pushes out the words.
You're wearing a mask.
Yes, I tore up a sheet to make one for me and Mario. Adriana's in Anacapri with Liliana. Stefania runs her tongue over her lips.
I have it, don't I? The Spanish lady.
Etta fills a water glass from a pitcher and, sliding her arms under Stefania's shoulders to prop her up, holds it to her cousin's lips.
Don't worry. Mario and I shall take good care of you. I must have caught it at the victory celebrations. Everyone was there.
Stefania convulses in violent shivers.
You must leave me, Etta. Adriana needs you. Liliana and Mario's parents need him, especially since his poor sister's passed in May. No one needs me.
I need you, cousin Stefania. Adriana and I love you. Mario and I shall be fine. We've disinfected everything with Creolina. We're boiling all the dishes and utensils and wearing these masks.
You would not love me if you knew what I have done.
Whatever do you mean? Get my key ring on top of the chest of drawers, please. Etta finds Stefania's keys beside the silver vanity set.
I have them.
Open the bottom drawer, the smallest key.
Why?
Please, Cara. Etta kneels on the rug and, after unlocking the drawer, yanks it open with a tug. There's a box at the back. Etta reaches behind the scarves and finds the wooden box.
Open it, Cara.
Etta lifts up the lid. She picks up the top letter on the stack and stares at the handwriting. Then she picks up the next and the next. She turns to face her cousin as her heart races.
You had Carlo's letters?
Yes, Cara.
All those months, when I thought he might be dead. All that time you had them?
Yes.
Why did you hide them from me?
Because I love you, Cara Mia. You are my family, just as your mother is.
I saw how Cristina was destroyed by the man who had claimed to love her,
how he'd abandoned her with a baby. When I discovered that Carlo was married and had a son, I couldn't let him do the same to you.
Carlo would never abandon us. I hated him, Etta. I hated him for what he did to you, what he's done to Adriana.
He's done nothing to Adriana. Stefania struggles onto her elbows. Her dark eyes flash in her flushed face.
He has made Adriana a bastard. Our precious angel has no name.
She collapses back onto the pillow, perspiration rolling down her cheeks like tears.
Adriana has a name. She is a Marinetti and she is a Fry. Her father and I shall raise her to be a proud, strong woman. My daughter has a name, and no one can take it from her.
Mario looks up from his perch on the chair beside Stefania's bed as Etta enters the bedroom 3 days later.
How is she, Mario?
She had another nosebleed, but she's sleeping now. She's not shivering like she was.
Good. Go have supper. I've made spaghetti alla Nerano with the leftover zucchini. Then go have some rest. I'll take over tonight.
No, Signora Etta. I can sleep for a few hours and come back at midnight.
You've done enough today, Mario. Get a good rest and come at 6 o'clock in the morning. I need you to help me set up one of the spare rooms for Adriana when she comes back. She's big enough for her own room now.
When he has left, Etta approaches her sleeping cousin. The laudanum has settled Stefania into a peaceful slumber, though drops of perspiration collect on her forehead. Etta wets a cloth in the bowl of water and wipes her cousin's face. She watches Stefania's chest rise and fall under the blankets.
You are quite the keeper of secrets, cousin Stefania. About my mother's affair, about Celie's birth, about Carlo's letters. So many secrets. What am I to do with all this information, this burden of secrets?
She rubs her temples and sits in the bedroom chair.
She's so tired. She can't think about that now.
She unties her mask and takes the bottle of laudanum and a spoon from her skirt pocket. Twisting off the cap, she then carefully pours out a spoonful and drips the brown liquid into her mouth. She grimaces as the bitter narcotic passes over her tongue and down her throat. Then she closes her eyes and waits for sleep to come. Part 7 1919 Chapter 80 Etta Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, January 1919. Etta looks over from her canvas at Mario, who is diligently copying the shape of one of the lemons in the bowl she has arranged on a table in the sitting room, while Stefania naps in her favourite chair by the window.
Can I make a suggestion, Mario?
Yes, of course, Signora Etta.
Loosen your shoulders. Roll them around in a circle, like this.
She rolls her shoulders and twists her head from side to side.
Your hand is very tense. Here, take one of my new brushes from Josie in Naples. They're the best quality. Hold your brush lightly, and don't worry so much about copying the lemon exactly. Try to paint the essence of the lemon.
Mario's dark eyebrows draw together. I don't understand.
Of course, you can paint the lemon exactly as it looks. The great Dutch and Flemish painters of the 17th century prided themselves on the realism of their still lifes. An artist named Adrian Corter painted 12 paintings of asparagus in order to perfect it. Can you imagine that? But there is another way to paint, Mario, a more modern way. The painter Picasso once told my husband that a circle doesn't have to be round. That is a good lesson.
Mario looks over at Adriana, who is sitting at a small table he has set up for her, covering sheaves of paper with yellow lemons with Etta's yellow drawing pencil.
Did you hear that, Adriana? A circle that isn't round, and a painter who paints nothing but asparagus. Isn't that silly?
Adriana looks up at Mario, her cheeks dimpling as she giggles.
It's very silly, Mario. You eat asparagus. You don't paint asparagus.
But we're painting lemons, and we eat lemons, don't we?
Adriana's dark eyes flash.
We only eat lemons in Lily's cake, so it's okay.
Did I hear someone say cake?
Etta spins around, cadmium yellow paint flying off her brush across Carlo's uniform.
Carlo!
Stefania jolts awake.
What? What is it?
Etta rushes over to Carlo, but he stops her before she throws herself into his embrace. Touches a finger against his lips and, reaching inside his jacket, carefully extracts a tiny ball of ginger fur. The kitten blinks its green eyes and mews.
Do you remember me, Adriana, il mio piccolo angelo? I'm your papa.
Adriana stares at Carlo.
Mama drew me your picture, papa. Did she? Do I look like the picture?
Adriana tilts her head and inspects Carlo's face.
Yes.
She reaches out to pet the kitten, giggling when it rubs its head against her fingers.
Do you like the kitten?
Adriana nods, her golden curls bouncing on her shoulders.
I have to give him to his owner.
Oh. He sets the kitten on Adriana's lap.
He's your kitten, Angelo mio. He's a little boy. You need to be his mother and give him a name.
Adriana takes the kitten carefully into her arms, cradling it like a baby. She beams at Carlo.
Thank you, Papa. I shall love him forever and ever. I shall call him Alice. Alice is a girl's name, sweetie, Etta says.
Adriana sticks out her lower lip in a pout.
I like Alice. It's like Alice in the story you read me.
Carlo runs his hand over Adriana's soft curls.
I think Alice is a splendid name for the cat. You're spoiling her, Carlo, Stefania says as she rises from her chair. I'll tell Liliana to prepare tisana.
She's already doing that, Stefania. Carlo reaches an arm around Etta. She met me at the door and hurried off as fast as a runaway train to the kitchen.
Then I shall see about some biscotti. Mario, come help me.
But, Signora Albertini...
Mario, now.
Carlo watches the two disappear through the doors into the sitting room. He shakes his head.
I don't believe she likes me. I don't care what she thinks, my darling.
Etta reaches up and traces the lines of his face with her fingers.
I can't believe you're here, Carlo. Cara mia, I have dreamt about this day.
He leans forward and kisses her.
Papa, Adriana exclaims, what are you doing?
I'm kissing your mamma. Is that all right, Patatina?
Adriana kisses the cat on its soft head.
Like I'm kissing Alice.
Exactly. And why are you kissing Alice?
Adriana buries her face in the cat's ginger fur.
Because I love him.
And I'm kissing Mama because I love her. And we can all now be a family together.
He leans toward Etta and whispers in her ear.
Etta, Mariana has passed away.
Etta gasps.
It happened suddenly, in her sleep.
Perhaps it was the kindest thing.
She is with little Gabriella now.
Do you know what this means? We're free, Carlo. Finally.
Carlo runs the gloved fingers of his left hand down the sleeve of Etta's dress. He sweeps his eyes over her, as if she is an apparition, as if she might dissolve into the quiet darkness of the bedroom. Outside, a gentle rain has begun to fall, and raindrops splash like tears onto the glass panes of the window. He brushes his lips along her neck. Her shoulders shake with a shiver of pleasure. His mouth finds hers, and the world is her mouth and her searching tongue. She reaches for his hands, but he pulls away.
What is it, Carlo? What's the matter?
Etta, I must tell you something.
About Mariana? You don't need to say anything. I'm sorry she has died, of course, but...
No, my darling.
He holds up his left hand. Take off my gloves. This one first. Etta takes hold of the soft brown leather and pulls the glove off his hand. He reaches for her face and caresses it with his fingers. No, the other one. She pulls at the leather and gasps as the mangled hand is exposed.
Carlo, what happened?
A mine. I was lucky. Many men were killed. She slides her fingers into his damaged hand.
Does it hurt?
No. The tendons and nerves have been cut. I feel nothing.
But you paint with your right hand.
I must learn to paint with my left. She raises his hand to her lips and kisses the scarred fingers.
I'll help you, Carlo. We'll manage.
There were times I thought you were a dream, Etta. But then one of your letters would come, and I would read your words over and over until they were such a part of my mind that I knew I would never forget them. You and Adriana were all that kept me alive. She slides her hands over the rough wool of his uniform and caresses the soft skin of his throat, where his pulse throbs under her fingers.
I'm no dream, my darling. I always believed you would find your way back to us. I spoke to Adriana all the time about you, drew pictures of you, of all of us together. I prayed and I pleaded and I bargained with God for you to come back to us. I would have sold my soul just to have you back safely.
Don't say such a thing, cara mia. You must never think like that.
Oh, my darling man, I am simply happy you are back with me. So much has happened to both of us, I know that. We're together, that's all that matters. And we can marry now. We shall be a proper family. This is the best gift of all.
Carlo pulls Etta into his embrace and kisses her. I love you, Etta. I love you so much. They stand in the shadows of the room, entwined in each other's arms, as the rain taps softly against the window.